Matthew 28, we get to see what I think are some of the most precious insights into the kind of heart that Jesus has. Because we get to see his contact with people who made bold promises and then horribly failed. We get to see how the King of the Universe deals with forgetful, discouraged disciples who shouldn't have been discouraged. If they'd have believed him, they wouldn't have been discouraged, but they were. There are so many contacts that Jesus had with people. You can turn the monitor down just a little bit. That'll help the ring. There are so many people that Jesus had contact with. I read one calculation, somebody who likes to do these kinds of things. In fact, let me just read to you the list that I wrote down of all the people Jesus appeared to after the resurrection that we have record of. I mean, who knows how many actual people there were. At the empty tomb, he appeared to what we're going to look at today, to Mary Magdalene separately, to two travelers on the road to Emmaus, which Luke is the only one that records, and it's such a great story that we're going to read it today as well. Peter all by himself at Jerusalem. 11 disciples minus Thomas, because Thomas was so bummed out he didn't even show up for church. And it's a good example of what happens when you're so bummed out that you don't show up for church. You might miss out on something really neat. But here's what I love about Jesus. Jesus came back when Thomas was with them a week later and made up for what Thomas missed. 7 disciples fishing in the Sea of Galilee. We won't look at that today. 11 of them on a mountain in Galilee sometime later. And 1 Corinthians tells us that he appeared to 500 people at one time. All of these people were alive and kicking for a long time. And so claims that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, that, you know, the whole Passover plot idea, that it was all faked, would have been hard to carry off, although it's something people still believe, would have been hard to carry off because there were just so many eyewitnesses around. There were more eyewitnesses to Jesus being resurrected than there were to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Do people believe that he rose from the dead? Well, no, lots of Christians don't even believe that, which I would think, what's the point of even being a Christian if you don't believe that? If you just believe that it's a symbol. Well, Paul said it very succinctly when he was talking about our salvation. He said that Jesus' death for our sins wasn't the whole story, that he rose from the dead, and his resurrection was the proof that the sacrifice that he gave was accepted. And if he didn't rise from the dead, we're still in our sins. So it was the most important theme in the message of all of the apostles after the day of Pentecost as they went into all of the world. We don't have accounts of how it happened, which is probably good, but we do have accounts of what happened afterward. So we're going to look at the first part of Matthew 28 today. Stick your finger over in Luke chapter 24, because that's where the two guys on the road to Emmaus, and I love that story. And then we're just going to look briefly in John 20, the middle of John 20, and look at the whole Thomas just what I want you to see is the kindness of Jesus. Every single person he's going to talk to, the ones that he's going to convince that were unconvinced, every one of them failed him. Every one of them made promises and vows that they didn't keep. Have you ever made any promises to Jesus that you didn't keep? I have. I'm ashamed of that. That's why I cling to mercy and grace for my dear life. And I just love every time I get to see how Jesus deals with people who fail. It may not be what you think. I was raised in a church before I came to Calvary Chapel. I was raised in a church that really pretty much had all the visiting evangelists were angry men, and the pastor was an angry man. And when that's pretty much all you hear, the Sunday school teachers were pretty angry. You get the idea that God is angry. And so the message of the cross was Jesus hanging up on the cross, and don't you feel ashamed of yourself for what you made him do. And the whole message of this is love demonstrated. Amazing love that you, my king, would die for me, like we sang. And the beauty of the post-resurrection appearances, which I think tell you more about Jesus' heart than almost any other thing. So that was all lost on me. So I'm still filled with discovery every time I study this. I don't know if that happens to you, Mike, when you're studying, but you'll find some nugget that is just thrilling, and you think, how could I have read this 200 times and not seen this before? So, Lord, open our eyes to see and our hearts to receive. We saw in last week's episode the paranoia of the religious leaders, so worried that there was going to be some sort of a forged resurrection, that they had Pilate, the Roman official, post a guard of 50 soldiers. And then they put a Roman seal, which we don't know exactly what it was, but it was probably something like the old way that they used to seal important packages that were being shipped across the ocean on the freighters. They would run a wire around, and then where the wire joined, they would put a bit of wax, and they would stamp the seal, and you knew whether that had been violated very easily by just looking and seeing of whether it was cracked. And they put a Roman seal over this huge hockey puck shaped rock that had been rolled in the trench down the front of the tomb. And when those of you that go to Israel with us, we'll have communion about 30 feet away from there. And you'll get to see that spot. We'll walk in and sit down on the shelf. Still, it's still a thrilling thing for me. I've done it a bunch of times, and I realize this is history. This isn't fable. We have documented evidence where the tomb was, and like I said, documented more than the signing of the Declaration of Independence, that Jesus was seen, resurrected by some of the very same people who saw him murdered. So they put the seal on the tomb, knowing that it was punishable by death to violate a Roman seal. 50 guards, just a tad overkill. They needn't have worried about the disciples stealing the body. The disciples were long gone. They had totally wimped out. They abandoned him way back in the garden when he was arrested, which is why I find it so touching that one of the very first things he did is he made a beeline for them to tell them he wasn't mad at them and to reinforce what he told them 7 or 8 times, that he told them who was going to kill him, how he was going to die, how many days he would be in the grave, and that he was going to rise again. He told them time after time after time after time, and when it would have helped them the most to believe it, they didn't. So I love how he treats them. So there's the guard, you know, the Roman version of special forces, you know, their bandoleros with stun grenades and, you know, their rocket launchers all standing up in the corner and their swords sharpened and they're all standing around the tomb. And let's see what happens next. Chapter 28, Matthew. After the Sabbath, Shabbat is the Jewish way to say it, after Shabbat, at dawn on the first day of the week, that would be Sunday, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, there are 4 Marys that we know of. It was kind of a common name. So I'm not exactly sure which other Mary. from just reading this text, but one of the other Marys, they went to look at the tomb. They didn't believe Jesus had risen from the dead either. The difference between them and the big tough men was the big tough men ran away and were hiding. And the women were there because they just wanted to be there. I love that about women. They just loved Jesus. They wanted to be near where he was, even if he wasn't alive. So meanwhile, while the women are going to just stand by the tomb, there's a lot of meanwhiles in this passage. This is like a split-screen TV. There's like four different things going on at once. Remember, Matthew's chronology stinks. He's a numbers guy. He's an accountant, but he just doesn't get the chronology of things right. And we'll try to look at it as close to in order as we can, but it's difficult with Matthew. There was a violent earthquake, meanwhile, because an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. I don't know why that always makes me smile. Why did he sit on it? There. So much for your security majors, big bad Romans. Let's see how the big bad Romans responded to this. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow, and the guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men, frozen with fear. It wasn't the earthquake. It wasn't the hockey puck, humongous, big, heavy rock being rolled away. And whatever happened, the blaze of light when Jesus busted through the rock before the door was open. It was him. It was the angel. All of the angel manuals that I can find, every angelic appearance, the first thing they say to humans is, don't be afraid, which tells you a little bit about what they must look like. The angel said to the women, don't be afraid, because I know that you are looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He's not here. He is risen just as he said. I have five younger sisters. I'm a big brother. I can't read this without thinking neener, neener, neener in my mind. He's risen. Hello. Just like he said. I don't know. I'm sure that the angels don't do neener, 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 and probably there was no sarcasm in it, but that's the way it always strikes me. Come, in other words, if you don't believe me, come and see the place where he lay. John tells us an interesting little tidbit. He says that when they went into the tomb, where many of us have walked in and sat down on that shelf, the clothes, the shroud and the little napkin that they put over the face of the departed, were neatly folded in a pile when they walked in. I'm a compulsively tidy person. You probably never know it to look at me, but I am, except for kitty hair. So I wonder, who folded the clothes? Was it Jesus? Did Jesus, as he's just ready to bust out through the rock, look around and say, okay, am I missing anything? Do I have my cell phone or my glasses? Oh, mustn't have an untidy tomb, and he folds everything up. I don't know. I like to think it was the angel. The angel peeks in there and goes, carpenters. No one ever taught him how to make a bed. We learned this in angel boot camp, you know, you hospital corners, you know, you bounce a quarter off of it, and the angel just folds everything up, and that's in the Bob version, that's why. But I just love that little detail, which Matthew, buddy, dude, details, we want details. So we got to go to the other Gospels to get those details. So come see the place where he lay, then go quickly. That little adverb is meaningful. Go quickly and tell his disciples. Tell him he's risen from the dead and he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you'll see him. Now, I've told you. Did my job. Can I split this place now? Go back to heaven. And so the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid and yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. I love this. This just actually just makes me grin. Jesus interrupted his own orders. He just couldn't wait. Suddenly, Jesus met them. "Howdy," he said. If you have a New King James, does it say rejoice? I looked this word up because one of the commentaries I read said this was just a colloquial greeting like howdy or hey, which is really significant considering what just happened, that he just defied all the laws of physics, rose from the dead, and he sees these women. He talks to them like he just went down for a snow cone, and then he says, "Howdy, hey, how you doing?" And I don't like that rejoice thing. It's not an accurate translation of the Greek word when it's used in a salutation, because it's just got that Catholic vibe, you know, of the scowling Jesus with the halo around his head and that whole thing. This is a guy watching to see the reaction of his friends that he's not dead anymore. "Hey, what you been up to?" "I've been rising from the dead." And they came to him and they literally dove for his feet. They groveled at his feet and worshiped him. And then Jesus said to them, "Don't be afraid." Listen to this. This first time I noticed this word, it made me weep. "Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they'll see me." What? The angel called them his disciples. We would call them losers. We would call them wimps because they totally wimped out. What has Jesus called them? "Go tell my brothers." I'm not mad at them. They're my brothers. We're related. Read your calendar. Up at the top, the quote that we put on the calendar is that wonderful scripture from Hebrews that says that Jesus is not ashamed to call us his brothers and sisters. Remember who these guys are. These are the guys who boasted, who constantly argued about which of them was the greatest, who boasted they'd never let him down, and they failed him at the time he needed them the most. When he needed their support and prayer, they fell asleep. When he needed them to just be there for him, they ran away. Is he holding a grudge? Oh no, we can't wait to see the women. And he says, "Just tell my brothers, go to Galilee." Why Galilee? They were scared to death in Jerusalem. Galilee was familiar, safe territory quite a ways away. Now, another meanwhile, verse 11. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. I bet that was scary. When the chief priests, because the Roman penalty for violating guard duty was death. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep." Which meant that only the ones that were supposed to be awake would have been killed, but at least a few of them would have survived. "If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." Trouble is highly sanitized, that we will rescue you from the death penalty. Verse 15, so the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Now, when Matthew wrote this, it was a couple of decades later. Still lots of eyewitnesses alive and kicking. But isn't it interesting that that story still persists to this day? Flip over to Luke 24, because on another screen, inserted in your 52-inch plasma TV that you're watching this on, is this little vignette. And I love this too, because these are guys who, by their own admission, heard all of the eyewitnesses that Jesus had appeared to. They heard that he was alive, and they still didn't believe it, and they were on their way home bummed out. That same day, that would have been Sunday. Probably it would have to be later in the afternoon because the women would have had to have time to go see the disciples and tell them what they saw. And then Peter and John went to the tomb, and they, you know, so it would have had to been in the afternoon. These guys split town. Two of them were going to a village called Emmaus. Verse 13, by the way, Luke 24. They were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. Good day's walk. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. I don't know. I just love this. Who says God doesn't have a sense of humor? We know from studying the book of Job that God uses sarcasm. Something about this I just find great. He's just trotting along next to him. They don't know who he is. And he says, hey, 17, verse 17, what are you discussing together as you walk along? And they stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, how would you like to be him and have your name recorded for all of posterity? You know, you're the loser that didn't believe the eyewitnesses and they got tricked by Jesus. He asked Jesus, are you only a visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened in the last few days? I love this. Jesus says, what things? The Greek literally reads, what sort of things? What kind of stuff are you talking about? How did he keep from smiling? Oh, about Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, past tense, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. I think these are the saddest words of any of God's servants. Verse 21, but we had hoped, past tense, that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. I think we're just going to see so much evidence to think these are the last two guys I would have appeared to. If it was me, I would have said, I told you 8 times. The women told you. The disciples told you. That's it. If you don't believe me now, that's it. You'll find out eventually. But that's not my Jesus. He just said, you know, these guys don't get it. So I love this conversation that he has. What is more, it's the third day. All this took place. That sound of a horn honking that you're hearing is the clue bus honking its horn, wanting these guys to get on. They don't even see the clue bus, probably because they're downcast. Verse 22, in addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they'd seen a vision of an angel who said he was alive. And then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they didn't see. And he said to them, how foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe. Boy, there's the key. Slow of heart to believe. Did they have enough facts? They would have enough facts to stand up in any court of law. They were slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had spoken. Didn't Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? That keys back up to the deal in verse 21 where they said we had hoped that he was going to come and redeem Israel. We'll talk about disappointment that comes from unrealistic expectations. Because unrealistic expectations are the first step to disappointment. We think it's going to go a certain way, and it doesn't go that way, and so we're disappointed. Did Jesus redeem Israel? He didn't just redeem Israel. He redeemed the entire world, but not in the way that they were hoping. Beginning, I would have loved to hear this Bible study in verse 27, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all of the scriptures concerning himself. And as they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he were going farther, but they urged him strongly, "Stay with us. It's nearly evening. The day is almost over." And so he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it. Familiar? Sound familiar? Few hours, couple of days, 72 to 80 hours maybe earlier, he'd done the same thing. And he began to give it to them, and then their eyes were open. The verb is in Greek is it means to be deliberately open, which means that they were not able to recognize him at one point, and now they are because something has changed and doesn't tell us what. And then they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. Immediately, he was not theirs, what it means. And they asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us when he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" And they got up and returned at once to Jerusalem, where they found the 11 and those with them assembled together. And they said, "It's true. The Lord is risen." Duh, we told you. It's true. The Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon. No one's calling him Peter the Rock now, you notice. And then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. Back to Matthew. And on another screen on your plasma TV is another meanwhile. Verse 16. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, listen to this, verse 17. When they saw him, they worshipped him, and some doubted. Those two sentences are Matthew's account of the 33 verses that we just read. Matthew goes, "Oh, yeah, some people saw him, you know, some worshipped him, some people believed him." And you go, Matthew, dude, come on, you're missing some good stuff in here, which is why we have four Gospels. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations." We're going to look at the Great Commission, this is called, next week in some detail. But for now, I just want to let you know, and then we'll talk about it next week, but who knows who's going to be here. Did I say that out loud? The verb in the sentence in verse 19, the first verb, is a participle. This has been, it's been misquoted for centuries. It's literally going. It's a participle, and then the make disciples or preach the gospel, some of the other translations say, that part of it is an imperative. But it could literally and should literally be translated going into all the world. Preach the gospel, make disciples of every creature as you are going. And check me out on that, as I'm sure somebody will. Well, that's as far as we'll get today, and I'm pretty sure that we'll be able to look at all that, but there are some details I couldn't resist commenting about that are noteworthy.